Welcome to the Gospel Rain podcast, part of the teaching ministry of Dr. Matt Brown and Dr. Micah Carter. We're glad you've joined us today for gospel-centered conversations of two like-minded pastors who want to see the gospel of Christ reign in the hearts of God's people. We would love to hear your feedback and your questions. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/gospelrain or go to @gospelrain on Twitter. We hope you will find gospel-centered answers to your questions about theology and the Christian life. And now, we welcome you to the Gospel Rain conversation.
Welcome back to the Gospel Rain podcast. Excited you're with me, and I am minus a host today. Micah is away in Alaska, of all places, and he wanted me to make sure that you know Micah is not on a mission trip. He's on a fishing trip. So he's spending a week in Alaska with some family fishing. He sent me a picture just a moment ago before I started the podcast just to make me jealous of the Alaskan horizon and the water. And so it's beautiful where he is right now, I'm sure. But I am not flying solo. I have a guest with me today, a special guest. He's a guy that I've gotten to know just a little bit over the last, last couple of years. And we have an opportunity to spend a little bit of time together today talking about a subject called discipleship. Greg is a friend of mine. Greg is a pastor at First Baptist Church, New Albany, Mississippi, where he's been the pastor almost 4 years. He's married to Kimberly. He's got three kids, Hannah Beth, Alden, and Gabe. Greg's been in the ministry for about 20 years, 12 of those of which he has spent as a pastor. And has some interesting insight into the topic we're going to talk about today, because he is currently a doctor of ministry. I guess you call that a student?
Professional student.
Professional student at Southeastern Seminary. That's also where he earned his master's degree, and he got his undergraduate degree from Mississippi College. And so anyway, have a privilege of being able to sit down with Greg, talk just a little while about a subject that is near and dear to my heart. Discipleship. Micah and I have talked a little bit about this over time. We have spent some personal conversations about discipleship and the meaning of it and the need for it in our local churches. We've spent maybe a podcast or two, and we've hinted at it, but we wanted to spend some time talking about discipleship. So Greg is working on his doctor of ministry degree, as I said, in the area of discipleship, which is sort of right in your wheelhouse, Greg. So this is good.
We hope to find out whether or not I'm going to pass this thing or not.
Hopefully you're going to be graduating soon. We assume you're going to be graduating soon.
That's
at least
right.
Your wife hopes so.
Exactly.
And the rest of your family. So Greg, I'm going to jump right into the conversation. I've got some questions I want to ask you, and we'll just jump back and forth. And let's talk about this, because listeners need to know, our church members need to know, what it means to be a disciple and what is the process of becoming a more mature disciple, and what does that look like? What can that look like, or what should that look like for them? We're trying as pastors to lead people from point A to B to C and all the way down the line. We're trying to help move them along in the growth spectrum as a disciple. But I found out as a pastor, a lot of people that may be sitting in our pews don't know first that they're supposed to be in this process of growth or discipleship. And I'm afraid sometimes we miscommunicate. We get people saved, and then we just sort of say good luck, and hopefully they'll figure it out on their own. So we want to talk a little bit about this. So as we jump in, let me just ask you first to define it for us. What is discipleship, and then is there a biblical mandate? If so, what is that?
Well, Matt, that topic, in particular when you talk about defining the term discipleship, everybody and their brother has a definition of what a disciple is. And some of those definitions are more elaborate than others, and some of them are very simplistic. And I'm a very simplistic guy, and so I try to minimize it to the least common denominator that
right.
I can, so that
right.
my people can understand what it is. And we basically here in our church came to the point a disciple is a follower of Jesus Christ. Okay. We tried to just simply put it that way.
That because, is simple. That's good.
Because you can tack on this and this and this and this, and then you realize once you've got that definition, you forgot something else, and you need to tack that on. But we just need to kind of minimize it to the common denominator at that point. And a disciple is a follower of Jesus Christ.
Okay, that's good. That's good for all of us to be able to put our finger on, at least to those who are sitting in the pew. They can understand. So would you say then everybody that is saved, we use those terms in Baptist life. Anyone who is saved is automatically then a follower of Christ. Is that true? Not true?
I would say so if they are truly repented and have understood what the gospel means, that they are sinners by nature and by choice, and that because of that sin nature that they have, they would not spend eternity with the Lord. Mm-hmm. And they've come to that point where they realize that and they put their faith and trust in the atoning work of Christ on the cross. Therefore, they are followers, because that's what the language that Jesus spoke in, come and follow me.
That's good.
And it's pretty consistent when you read Jesus. And like I said, I don't believe Jesus was a difficult person to understand.
Right.
I really think that I think through the generations we've kind of maybe clouded the waters a little bit more than Jesus had anticipated us to do. Well, anticipated is probably not the right word to use there, but where we probably shouldn't be able to go there.
Right, right. Well, all right. So, what is the biblical mandate then for us to become followers of Christ? If we're going to teach our people as pastors, at least how to define that, and then what that means for them personally sitting in the pew, where do we go in the Bible to find that? What does the Bible say about discipleship?
Well, you know, Jesus, you know, was not born in a vacuum. I mean, he was born in a historical period of time, and therefore his context of his earthly ministry here had some context to it, and it was obviously a Jewish context. And so you've got to understand from the get-go that that's the context that Jesus is working from, because we see all the way from the very beginning, you go back to the book of Deuteronomy, and Deuteronomy tells us there in Deuteronomy chapter 6, this was just called the Shema,
right.
to love the Lord your God. He's one. You shall love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words that I have commanded you shall be on your heart today. And then verse 7 tells us very clearly there's a distinction or a pattern that's laid out for us. You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall walk. You shall talk to them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand. Should ever be before you is what he's saying there. They shall be on your frontals, between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorpost. So we see even in the Old Testament, there is this precedent that's set from the very beginning in the Jewish culture to make disciples. And again, Jesus would have been that rabbinic model. And and basically in the rabbinic model, we know that a rabbi would take those people who had excelled in the Torah school, to say, and he would have taken those people and he would have trained them. They would have been followers of those rabbis, and there have been certain things that would have taken place in order for that to happen. And Jesus follows that model as well, too. But instead of waiting for applicants, Jesus does something different. He goes and he chooses his disciples, and there's a little bit of difference in that, and he's still doing that today.
Yeah, isn't that where... And back in their time, normally a rabbi, people would come and say, can I please follow you?
Mm-hmm.
Or can I learn from you? Can I sit under your teaching and that kind of thing? And you're saying that Jesus actually went and chose them.
Yeah, they, you know, the school, they learned from the Torah how to read and to write and all those things. And as those people and those students progressed, if they've got to a certain point in their teenage years where they were deemed to be, you know, viable students, then the rabbi would consider, because he had a lot of applicants. I mean, because everybody was trying to get through. That was the, quote, collegiate system of the day. They were trying to get through that. But, you know, it's not meant for everybody. And
that's
so there
right.
would be professional people that come out. You look at your disciples. They were all professionals. And which, again, is so insightful in the way that Jesus calls his disciples, that he uses everyday people, not just the academia of the world, but he uses everyday hardworking people to do his purposes.
You know, you said something. I've got some other questions. I want to take us in a different direction in just a second. But the Shema that you read from Deuteronomy earlier, it's interesting that this was intended, or at least it seems in my reading, this was intended first of all for families, for parents to teach their children. So there's an interesting dynamic when it comes to discipleship that I'm afraid sometimes we lose, which is maybe the idea of family discipleship. If we can take it this way for just a few minutes, what is the responsibility then biblically for the family to do that? Do we still think that's a – because a lot of times I'm afraid we relinquish all of our responsibility to the church. We delegate it to the pastor and whatever. You teach my kids, and to the children's minister, you know, you teach my kids. Is there still responsibility for the parents to do that, which it seems – was so in Deuteronomy?
I agree 100%. And in our church, we have what's called the 8 D's of discipleship. And one of those D's is to disciple others, beginning with your own household. Mm-hmm. And we use this passage out of Deuteronomy to set that precedent for that, because that is our first circle of discipleship. As followers of Jesus Christ, when we are called to make disciples, because we multiply, that's so important in discipleship that is so often overlooked, is that our first ring of discipleship are those in our immediate family. And those of us who are married and have children, you know, obviously we are to disciple each other in the beginning with our family, because, you know, you've got your children more so than a church staff does. And
that's right.
I think it's really unfair for us to really throw that on our church staff, is that their responsibility. It's your responsibility to disciple my children. No, mm-hmm. we're there to come alongside you, to provide you resources, to teach you how to do that. And our staff does the best of their ability, but it sometimes doesn't work out like you want it to, but I believe that's the precedent that's set.
That's an interesting thing, and I think we sometimes are missing the mark there. And I don't know that all parents just don't want to disciple their kids, but I don't know that they know how. And that's a big deal. A lot of parents are struggling to know how to do that.
Yeah, I think it's both of those categories there. It's hard work.
Yeah.
It's hard work for me to disciple my own children. I'm the pastor. I mean, it's a discipline that you have to get into. And then I have parents come to me all the time. I just remember having a conversation with one of the fellas in my church here a week or so ago. He said, I want to be that dad that prays for my children, that disciples my children, but I don't know how. Mm. And so I believe — we're going to probably get into this later — but I believe that's one of the things that as pastors that we probably have overlooked so often, is that one of our primary responsibilities is being a disciple maker ourselves, teaching people how to make disciples. And we don't give the attention to that. And there's a lot of different reasons for that, because of, you know, churches and the administrative side that comes with that as being a pastor.
Right,
you're a problem solver, and therefore you don't have time to really be a disciple maker. And so we've got to get into that, to the habit and to the discipline to make time to be able to make train people, particularly parents, how to make disciples, how to disciple your children.
That's a good point. We're going to try to come back to that maybe in a little bit. I'm going to try to revisit that for those who say, yeah, I'm that person. I'm listening, and I want to know how to disciple my kids. Hopefully we can give you a little bit of insight as parents to know how to do that. Maybe toward the end of the podcast, we want to hopefully put some ideas into your head about what to do from there as a parent. But let me shift gears if I can. And let's go back to the ministry of the church. Not that family discipleship is not a church ministry, but get back into the ministry of the church. Is there any way to know how to strategically help people grow into more mature disciples? We want, as we said earlier, we want to move people from A and B and down the line. How do we effectively do that with intentionality and with the ability to, at the end, evaluate it and say, we have done well or we have not done well? Is there a way to do that strategically? And I know this is some of the stuff you've been thinking through some in your professional student life. You've been thinking through it. And as a pastor, too, help us understand, how do we do that strategically?
Wow, that's the million-dollar question. And if we could market that, you and I could both do this full-time if we wanted to.
Well, there's a lot of books on this stuff.
There are, but you know, one of the things that you have to do, and however you do it, there are some tools out there to kind of gauge your people and just to kind of see where they're at. You know, not that I'm a commercial here or anything, but, you know, Lifeways, their transformational church.
That's
an online tool that as pastors you can do to kind of gauge your people on that, just to kind of see where they are in their spiritual formation. But one of the things that you've got to be able to do as a pastor, and if you're training disciples, how to make disciples, is to be able to see where people are already. I love the way that Jim Putnam does it with Real Life Church out in Spokane, Washington. I had a chance to go out there a couple of years ago just to kind of see his model of what he does. And he talks about the five different stages of, that people go in. You know, that you have the, those that are spiritually dead. Those are people that are lost without Christ. Then you have what's called an infant, maybe a new believer, and then they've got some characteristics that go with them. Then you have a child, young adult, then a parent, and just helping under people understand where they are in that particular circle there, and then helping people who are making disciples be able to determine and to gauge that and to see where they need to go from that process. But as far as measuring those things, there's a lot of things that people think are more important than the others. One of mine, obviously, is that you're Christ-like in the way you approach life, and you're centered on your life. He is the center of your life. But you know, are you making disciples that multiply, that make disciples too? And so there's a lot of different ways you can look at it. And just as a pastor, which one's more important to you?
You made reference to something that a lot of, we say a lot, and I'm guilty of this as a pastor, but I don't know that I give a lot of answers for, but this idea of a disciple, or a real disciple, is somebody who makes another disciple. A real disciple is somebody who reproduces,
correct,
right?
Correct.
So we say this a lot, but I'm afraid a lot of times to those who listen to us, they may think, well, I'm not a pastor. I don't have resources and tools. I've not gone to school my whole life professionally to be a pastor. I've not studied theology, and I've not studied all of these things, and I don't know how to do that. Some people would say, I'm just lucky to be one myself. You know, I'm not really worried about reproducing. How do we as pastors, and maybe you can help the rest of us pastors that are maybe listening to the podcast today, how do we as pastors communicate that well? How do we communicate that better? And then how do we put resources in people's hands to help them, the ordinary Joe sitting in the pew who says, okay, I want to be a disciple. Fine, I will be a reproducer. I want to make another disciple. I have no idea where to start. I have no idea what to do. How do we do that? How do we help them as pastors?
Well, one of the things that we need to understand as followers of Jesus Christ is that is a mandate that's been given to us to go and to make disciples. Now, and there's no discussion about it. There's no optional there. That may look different for every one of us. But I believe that the key to all of that is, first of all, is availability. Just being available and being,
that's a good point,
and being willing and being open to the Lord to using you, because you're never going to know all the answers to all the questions, but you're never asked to know all those things either. And if you believe in the power of the Holy Spirit in the moment, in that divine moment of truth, as you're either sharing the gospel or either you're walking with someone or you're trying to do a podcast, whatever it is at that particular moment, it's just the being the available. Obviously, there's some great resources and great tools to have in your hand to do that, and we'll talk more about those in just a minute. But I believe that's the biggest part, and I think that as far as pastors, again, coming to the point where you realize that is such a vital part of your ministry, that's the part of your ministry that's going to leave the legacy, is what you do and pouring into other people. But as a pastor, it can be an overwhelming experience. I mean, you can look at it and say, oh my goodness, how can I ever do that? But discipleship, I believe it's a long term. You got to look big picture. You know, I tell people all the time, I want to be able to look back on my deathbed and say I was faithful with people, with the relationships that I have, and understanding for the person who works at a job, not a church job, but even every relationship that you have in your work, that's a discipleship relationship. Even they may not be saved, but you're beginning to plant those seeds, and God is faithful, and He will honor those things. And so with your children, so taking every relationship that you have and turning that into a gospel relationship and helping people and pointing people to Jesus.
That's fantastic. I love how you say, how you mentioned the word several times, relationships. I think a lot of times in churches, and again, I'm guilty of this too, but we think in discipleship terms, a lot of times as pastors, that it's a program, right? We got to have discipleship. That what we mean by that, we got to have a program. We got to fill the 5 o'clock slot on Sunday or whatever that, you know, time is. And so I want to have discipleship. And a lot of times what we mean by that is, let's have a class, and let's do a class, and we're going to do a class on, you know, 10 steps to becoming financially free or whatever.
Yeah.
And if we're doing that, that's discipleship. Now, I'm not knocking that program. Right, I'm not knocking the class. But I think a lot of times we think that that is discipleship. But you made a point that discipleships are relationships, not programs.
I agree 100%. And I think if you look over the course of history and the different models or different models of discipleship through the period, as much as a historian and a lover of the Reformation period I am, I believe this is probably one of the downfalls that we inherited from the Reformation, because we turned discipleship into an academic exercise.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And therefore we lost a lot of that relational side of it. We do things like called equipping classes, and many of our churches, we had what was called discipleship training for years and years and years.
Training union.
And again, there's a place for all those things, but that is just a tool to come alongside, I believe, real nuts and bolts, rubber meets the road type of discipleship, because I believe it is relational. And again, in churches, we want the big events. We want all those things. And those are fun. Those are the times and place. But I'll tell you an illustration that I kind of help my people understand this, and it's not original for me, but it was J.D. Greer a couple of years ago at the pastor's conference, and he, in a sermon that he preached there at the pastor's conference, he talked about some dynamite, and I don't know if you heard this one, but he talked about it, and I could take a bunch of dynamite, and I could shoot it up in the air, and it would blow up, and man, you would have a boom, a loud, loud noise, and you will know that it was there, okay?
Right.
But in 5 minutes, you wouldn't know it was there anymore. Right. But you can take that same dynamite, you put it in the ground, and you blow it up. You're not going to have the big boom, but you'll know it's been there.
Oh, wow.
And
that's
I think that's as far as relationships, we've been so event-driven, and because that's kind of the business model, and that's where I guess the business side of has creeped into the church, when we're obviously a different animal for sure. We're a living organism, but we want the big things. We want the quick success. We want to see all these things, and I believe that relationship building is a slow process. Mm. And in our instant society, we just don't want to spend the time doing that. And plus, it's messy.
Yeah.
When you're dealing with people, it's messy.
Yeah.
When you deal with real life issues, you're gonna feel it sometimes, and a lot of us just don't want to do that.
Yeah, one of the things that I think our folks can at least glean from this is, if you want to be a disciple, you want to be a reproducer, you want to go and make another disciple, you can't do that unless you're building relationships with people. So start there. That's a great place
great
to start.
Great place to start.
Go make relationships with people. You may know somebody in your church that is younger than you. Maybe you're a man in the church, and you've been in the church all your life, and you know a man or two younger men in the church who have not been in the church all their life. Go develop a relationship with those two young men. Go take them out to eat. Go invest in their life and start there. You don't have to start with a 26-week in-depth Bible study to call that discipleship. You got to start somewhere. And it's a good place to start is with relationships.
Yeah, I guess you can say one of the frustrations of being a pastor is that a lot of times you're around church people all the time.
Well, that's true.
And you have to just kind of have to come out of your bubble sometimes. And I tell my wife all the time, who's a school teacher, and I said, I'm jealous of you. You're around people, different types of people. And so take advantage of those opportunities. Your job, just to, again, developing those relationships, being available, taking the time, and starting and building a friendship. As my mentor used to tell me, people don't care how much you know till they know how much you care.
That's right. That's right. And that's a good point for us as church members, to be able to start somewhere, build relationships, go from there. There are resources you can find. There are ways to be able to say, okay, now that I've developed a relationship, how do I capitalize on that? How do I then sit down with somebody and make a disciple? Well, there are tools you can sit down. There are resources. You can sit down with that Bible study and go, okay, look, let's study the Word together. Let me share some things. But it's not all just Bible study. There are life lessons that you can teach a young man. Or if you're a woman in the church that's been successfully married for 30 years, and you see this young couple has been married 5 years, they're struggling, develop a relationship with that young lady. And you may have some expertise that you can pour into that young lady's life and help her raise those little kids and know how to go through all those days of of, like we were talking about earlier, giving baths and all that, how do you survive those days? You know, that's part of the disciple making process, is begin to develop and build relationships with people. And then once you've developed a relationship, then you can take it from there and say, hey, let's sit down together and talk about some things.
Yeah, that's perfect. I couldn't have said it any better. But one of the dangers that we find ourselves in, particularly as church people who've been in church a long time, sometimes we forget how lost people think and
that's true.
And act, and we don't understand that, and we want to come in with guns loaded, Bibles ready to thump people on top of the head. Again, if you've not built that conversation, if you've not earned the right to have that next conversation, you're going to set yourself up for failure. Because again, this millennial generation, they don't like to be told what to do. They're anti-authoritarian. Right. Yeah, right. They don't like people just coming in and bossing them around and telling them, well, you got to get your act together. They just don't like you to do that. But they will definitely take somebody who has had experience to be able to walk alongside them, just to share their experience and say, hey, this is what worked for me. This is what didn't work for me. And they're open to that. But again, you've got to earn the right for that conversation.
There are right now in contemporary church life, there's discussions right now going on, have been for a while, about the differences of Sunday school versus small group stuff. Okay, and that's a big hot topic right now. You talk to any pastor, and they go, well, we're doing small groups. And some are going, I don't like small groups. We're doing Sunday school. And some people say, well, we do both. And we're all over the map when it comes to this kind of stuff. And usually this stuff comes along every several decades or so. We repackage it, and we call it something else. And I don't know. I think at least we're struggling with and trying to grapple with, how do we do this better? So that's a good thing. Help us through this. What's the difference in these things, first of all, and then we'll maybe talk about some advantages, disadvantages, whatever your opinion might be.
Oh wow, that's huge. A little bit about my context. I am in a traditional county seat First Baptist Church. Therefore, we have since 1843 we've been here, and so we do things certain ways.
Right.
And like many of your churches, if you're particularly in Mississippi or in the South, you deal with this. And Sunday school is part of our DNA. That's who we are. And because of that, we still invest heavily in the Sunday school model in a lot of ways, namely because we've got millions of dollars worth of facilities,
right,
and you can't
just
walk away from those things. But you see now these that are, you know, church plants that are coming up, those who are newer churches, Sunday school is not part of their DNA. I've been to some conferences before that just do small groups, and they find out that I do Sunday school, and I think they look at me like I have horns growing out of the top of my head. They're like, oh, yeah, you do Sunday school. And there's some negative connotations. I guess the word Sunday school is a good place to start. We might want to change the vocabulary there.
Right.
And, you know, we call those small groups, but changing the word. But I believe that the Sunday school model still can work. We still do that very effectively. It takes hard work for us to do that. But who's to say that your Sunday school has to just be for 50 minutes to an hour on Sunday morning? If that's all your Sunday school is, then that's your fault. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's because it can be so much more. And that's what we encourage, you know, our Sunday school classes, to take it outside the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Do fellowship things together. Do ministry together. Do life together. Therefore, you can do so much more than just stuck in that little block, that cubicle that you're at on Sunday morning. Yeah, again, small groups, that whole model, it's a little bit different than Sunday school. It's a little bit more mobile, a little bit more flexible, not quite as structured at times. And those are good, too, and that's a good model. Some churches are trying to do both. I'm not so sure. It's a little bit of redundancy to me.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think you can do what you're trying to accomplish in small groups if you'll have the freedom to do it in your Sunday school. And again, that's part of the leadership change, a little bit the culture, and trying to cast that vision with your Sunday school leaders. And I'm thankful that I have an associate pastor that believes that, and a Sunday school director that buys into that and knows that, hey, we've got to be flexible. How can we reach lost people? That's the bottom line. Is it better in a Sunday school class, or is it in a small group?
That's a good point.
If you have a traditional Sunday school, and you think, because maybe the location where it is, maybe you need to try having some things at somebody's house with your Sunday school class, inviting lost neighbors and lost friends. Again, don't hamstring yourself. Don't box yourself in doing things the same old way. Be creative and go out there, you know, and just try it. See what happens.
What are you, as a pastor, tell me some of your... a little bit of your opinion. You hinted at this, and you may not want to go too far into this because you may offend maybe your own church members. I don't know. You may offend some pastor friends. I don't know. Give me a little bit of your opinion that you hinted at. Good or bad, small groups versus Sunday school, what are some negative things to that? What are some things you would say, this is why I don't like it, or this is why I do like it? What are some things you would give?
Yeah, when my first church, somebody asked me, do you do small groups? I was like, yeah, we do one small group. That's all we do because that's all we've got. We got one small group. Well, you know, one of the things I think that small groups can fall into some of the same traps that your traditional Sunday schools can fall into. What happens in a small group is that, first of all, you don't multiply. You got to go in understanding that at a certain point, you're going to need to multiply. You need to begin developing leaders inside that small group, just like we do with a Sunday school. We have an apprentice that we're training to take over that class in case we need to divide that class up. And once it gets bigger.
Wait, in Baptist life, we can't say divide. We can't use negative.
We birth new units.
Thank you.
We birth new units. Yeah,
terms.
My associate pastor doesn't like me to say divide because that's like divide and conquer.
That's right. Nobody likes that word.
We birth new units. We're blessed here that I've been here almost 4 years, and we have a 30-something class that has birthed about three times.
Wow.
And so God has done some amazing things from that, and I've got one of those classes that may have to birth again, and they're a little resistant to that because they like their class, and I'm thankful for that. Same thing can happen in a small group. You can get so attached that you forget about your purpose and what you're there for. And what happens is if you know, small groups, you usually invite your buddies and those things, but you have to be intentional. Intentional in who you want there, because again, small groups do have an advantage and use those. You know, you're not on a campus. You might be able to attract somebody that's not so keen about being in a church building, but if they'll go to a neighbor's house. But if you lose that focus, I think you've lost the whole focus of what the small group is about. So it's a huge element. And so you have to be really careful about that. Another danger with small groups is that it can become a splinter group too if you're not careful. And that's why in my discussion with pastors who do small groups, they seem to always have sermon-based discussion in those small groups. If you just leave them to do whatever they want to do, you don't know what they're studying. You don't know what the topic is. But you have a sermon starter from the sermon in the past to be able to start discussion. And therefore, I think you always make that connection back to the church. That this is not a splinter group trying to do their own thing. We are connected to a larger body, and we believe it's important for a body of believers to gather consistently to worship together. And so it's important to do those things. And if you're not careful, that can happen. Again, you know, you just you stay with the same group and you forget the multiplication process and you just spin your wheels.
Let me backtrack, and I may have gotten the cart before the horse, knowing that some of our listeners may not know what a small group, what the terminology is. And I am using air quotes that you can't see, but when we talk about small groups, a lot, maybe some of my folks or some of your folks, somebody else doesn't know. What are we talking about? What is a small group, as opposed to a Sunday school class? Is the difference there just simply because a small group maybe is not on campus of a church building and Sunday school group is on campus? Small groups is something you do at any time rather than just the 9:30 hour. Is that help us designate what are we talking about when we talk about small groups and Sunday school difference?
Yeah. Again, Sunday school, obviously you have the structure that you have inside the church context, whether it be in the facilities and all those things. A small group is a lot more flexible, a lot more mobile. Again, you have to understand what the purpose in your small group is, and that is to intentionally engage people who don't have a relationship, that are not followers of Jesus Christ. And so you want to keep those things in mind. As far as the time of day or when you do it, and that can be any time in a small group, you know, but with your traditional Sunday school, obviously you have some parameters in there you have to work in. For a lot of us, it's, you know, 9:15 to 10:45 on Sunday morning. No, that'd be 10:15. That's a long Sunday school hour. But and you're kind of hemmed in there. That's why in your Sunday school, you can still do the same things, but you're going to have to do them offside, off your campus.
Okay,
you're going
to
have to do other things. But in that small group, yeah, you need to have the flexibility to do that. And those that have gone to that model have, I guess you say, quote, permission from their church leadership or infrastructure to do that. And I think that's one of the things as a traditional church like myself and like we're at, giving people their permission to not necessarily meet the, quote, traditional time of the morning on Sunday. If you want to do your small group on Saturday night, hey, have the freedom to be able to do that. It's when you can do it the best. Okay. Right. You know, I've got friends who are church planters, and a lot of those people, we've been in Las Vegas the last several years, and they have to do theirs at different time because of the, you know, where they're at. They have a lot of people who work in the hotel industry. Mm-hmm. All right. And they have to work that graveyard shift. And so you do it around when people can,
okay, that makes sense.
Can work best. You're just not hemmed in by that traditional time on Sunday morning.
That makes a lot of sense. I like the distinction there, and I think providing a little bit of a definition for somebody who may not understand what we're talking about when it comes to that kind of idea, that may help us out a little bit. All right, so let me shift gears a little bit and come back to what we introduced earlier in the podcast, talking about specific advice for people who may say, okay, I want to be a disciple. I want to be faithful. I want to be a follower of Christ. I want to do all that entails, but I don't know what to do. I don't know where to start. Should I go talk to my pastor? Should I go find a book? Do I go to the bookstore? Do I start looking on Amazon? Is there a book of the Bible I start reading? Is there a combination to this lock that I'm trying to unlock in my life, discipleship? I hear the pastor talk about it. I hear that it's important. Okay, I buy in, but I don't know what to do now. I don't know. So help us with some advice for church members who want to be greater disciples. What do they do? Where do they go? What resources do they need? Give us a little bit of insight.
Well, I think, first of all, you have to commit yourself. You have to commit yourself to being a disciple yourself. Because you can't be a discipler if you're not a disciple yourself. That has to be a big part of it. That's one of our 8 D's of discipleship. The first D is devote yourself to being a disciple. That's the very first step in walking through that. And once you've done that, you spent time on your face and on your knees, and God showing you what it means to be a disciple. But again, I think it goes back to the availability, first and foremost. But you do need to probably seek some help. And in that regards, I mean, I'm not going to tell you don't go talk to your pastor, because I hope that people would come talk to me as their pastor. But there are some things, and I will tell you, if your church has a process, buy into that. I mean, your church staff has thought through those things, and they have done that to try to make it easiest for you. And so use those tools that they're using. Again, I've mentioned him already before, but one of the things that resources that I used early on was a book called Real Life Discipleship by Jim Putman. And he basically talks about how to make disciples, and he talks about things to look for and things to beware of, and just to really to be able to understand people a little bit better. You can pick his book up there. He's also got a workbook that I've led some of our people through of how to make disciples. And so those are good places to start. You talk about the Bible. I mean, you just look at Jesus, the way that he dealt with people. Again, it's not overcomplicated. And you see how Luke talked about those things in the book of Acts, and how those just kind of bled over into the book of Acts, and you begin to see those patterns there. You see a discipler. They're taking a group of disciples. He's showing them what it means to be a follower of Jesus. Then he begins to ease them in to allow them to do things together. Then you see that disciple maker just stepping back and letting the discipler to take a lead, and then multiplying themselves, and then he moves on to the next.
That's good. And you made a good point, too, that you're not going to be a disciple maker until you're first a disciple yourself, and you're not going to be able to effectively help somebody become a disciple unless you're daily in a relationship with Christ. And so you're not going to speed up the process of discipleship by doing things supernatural way, finding the right combination of things. It's going to begin with sitting down with the Lord on a regular basis, spending time with him, praying, growing in your own life first before you can actually help somebody else.
Yeah, and again, this goes back to the relational thing. Who are the relationships that God's already put in your life? Those are the circle of people that God has put you there strategically. He didn't put your pastor there.
Right.
I think there's a disconnect a lot of times when, you get a phone call, preacher, you need to go talk to so-and-so. Well, God didn't lay that person on my heart. I mean, I've got my list of people that I need to go see. That's your opportunity engage that person, to develop that relationship. But if it starts there on your face, God, show me. Because I promise you, if you ask him to show you, He will show you. He will show you every time. And so it's got to start there.
Yeah, because he wants you to succeed. Yeah. I mean, he gave you the job, right? Yeah. I mean, he tells you to do this. He will help you become a disciple and a disciple maker. But you're going to have to be committed. Like you say, you're going to have to be committed to the process. You're going to have to be committed to an ongoing, consistent, regular relationship with the Lord. You're going to have to be committed to relationships with other people. You're going to have to be committed to a number of things. So that's very helpful for those who are church members. Now, let me shift to another question, which is similar, but to maybe geared to a different group of people. What about our pastors? Those who are listening say, okay, I'm a pastor, and I want to be a disciple maker, and I want to help my people become disciples. How do I, as a pastor, do that? What is my role? What are the resources I can use? How can I effectively become a good pastor and help my people move from A to B to C and all the way down the line of their growth in discipleship?
Well, the first thing is that you have to be a disciple maker. I mean, it has to start there, and you model what that is to be a disciple maker. We started a couple of years ago what we call life groups, and it's where you have 3 to 4 guys or 3 to 4 girls. They're not intermingled
right
there. I've been through my second group now, and those that I've gone through with, you know, we tell them up front, hey, when we're through with this, after about 10 months to a year, we want you to go and to do the same thing, but we model for them what it looks like to be a disciple maker, and it has to start that way as a pastor. And so, you know, those are some very vital things. You have to make a commitment yourself to do that. There are a lot of neat resources out there for you to use. I'm gonna mention a couple of them. One that was really instrumental for me in our life groups was a book called "Cultivating a Life for God." It's a guy by the name Neil Cole out in California. Had a chance to meet Neil a couple of years ago, and he kind of developed with core of what we do for life groups. He called them life transformation groups, LTG. I didn't like the way that LTG sounded, so we call them life groups, living your faith every day. But they have 3 basic common elements. One is that you pray for each other, and you're praying for lost people as well. You're reading scripture, and there's a scripture reading plan, how you do those things. And then also you're holding each other accountable. There's some accountability questions that you come to. Very easy model. As I've said before, there are a million different ways you can do this. As a pastor, you just have to make the decision, we're going to do this, and we're going to go in with this one here. And see, the life groups, I've kind of tweaked it a lot, and I continue to tweak it after, you know, experience, and just kind of say, hey, this would work better if we did that. So, because we keep it at live on our website, and so people can go on and do that. And so there's different versions of that particular document that we have on there to do that. But he was great. If you're looking for things, we've mentioned, I think his name, Robbie Gallaty,
right.
Replicate Ministries. He does a great job. I mean, you can go onto his website and see a lot of different things. They call them D groups. It's the same thing. If you're looking for something a little bit deeper to go longer, there's a guy by the name of Greg Ogden wrote a book called Discipleship Essentials, about 24 weeks where you really hit some of the deep, deep, deep things. And it also has some supplemental things. And then a module that I was kind of introduced to when I came here, there was a group of guys already doing some things, and it's called, I called it the CLC group. They'd been meeting for 2 years at 6:30 on Friday mornings, and it's a 2-year commitment, but it's called Christian Leadership Concepts. And where you talk about what it means to be a spiritual leader of your home, particularly for men, and they've got a women's module as well too. But I think one of the neat resources, particularly, you know, as Baptists, we are always familiar with the survival kit. You remember
those?
Yeah,
I was about to mention that one.
The old survival kit. Here you go. I hope you survive. And that's really kind of
what
we did. Good luck to you. And we still have those around here. They're all kind of turned dingy orange and yellow because they're so old at this point. But, you understand what they were there for. But, Lifeway's gone back and redone that. And the Disciples Path stuff that they're doing, they have it's about 6 different modules that you work through, and you have enough material to work through for about a year. And that's for people who are very new believers. And so I believe that evangelism is the front door of discipleship.
Right.
And so you've got to start there. You're sharing the good news, sharing what it means to have a relationship, you're sharing the gospel with people, and then being willing to walk with that person. Again, in church, what we've done is that we've shared the gospel, and people have come to Christ, and then it's like, here, I hope you survive, and just pat you on the back and move on. But discipleship is so much more than that.
That's really, really insightful. I know one of the ways as a pastor I have done discipleship lately that I did not do early in my ministry, which I should be slapped for as a pastor, and didn't appreciate and didn't understand. But lately, over the last several years, I've been taking some smaller groups of guys, 4, 5, 6 guys, and pulling them aside for 13 weeks or 20 weeks or, you know, whatever, or more than that, and meeting with them regularly and sort of trying to invest in them relationally, trying to build relationships with them, and then find a resource. Look, like you said, there's a million out there, and if you're a pastor looking for, find one of them, just get your hand on one of them and start there. Grab a group of guys, get them around you once a week, let's sit down for an hour, let's pray together, let's talk through this stuff together, because these guys, if you're like the guys in my church, these guys are longing for something. Yeah. They want to learn how to pray. They want to learn how to read their Bible. They want to learn how to talk to their kids about Jesus. They want to learn how to go to work and live out their faith. They want to learn. They're waiting for somebody to take the lead. So if you're a pastor, take the lead. That's what God has put you there for, to make disciples.
Yeah, and I think you can even take it even a step further than that. You're not only walking with them, meeting with them. Like my life group, we meet 5:30 at the Waffle House.
Do you have to meet that early?
I've got a bunch of school teachers, and they have to be at school really early. All three of the guys that are in my life group are all school teachers, and they have teach at three different school districts in the counties around us. They're not actually in our county. But here's where I found it difficult as a pastor, particularly for me. Some of you guys may not deal with this. The gift of hospitality is not necessarily my spiritual gift or my wife's spiritual gift. Mm. But it's more than just meeting at 5:30. Invite those guys into your home with their families.
That's a good point.
Model to them what it is to love your wife as Christ loved the church. To interact with your interact with your children where you're not screaming at them and threatening to beat them or anything like that. You know, doing family devotions and inviting them in, just letting them see you do life, again, outside the structure where the Sunday school model gets the bad rap. We can also do that and if we're not intentional about really displaying life community, because I believe in the rabbinic model, and the way Jesus set the stone there is that he wanted them to taste and see and experience all that life had to offer in that regard.
That's good. Greg, man, this has been a fantastic set. We didn't get to near all the stuff that I wanted to get to. I mean, we had a lot of things I wanted to talk about, and I'm gonna bring this podcast to a close, but maybe we'll have the opportunity to talk about it a little bit more. I'd like to do that maybe in the future. We'll do a part two or something like that. There's just so much here when we talk about discipleship. So we're going to close with a segment that Micah and I normally call Did You Know? And so we just sort of ask and answer a question that you may or may not have known, or our listeners may or may not have known. It could be something funny, stupid, weird. It can be spiritual, it can be non-spiritual. Most of us are not. I'm going to start, since I'm the one talking, and then I'm going to throw it to you and ask you to sort of give us a did you know. And I did prepare Greg just a little bit before the podcast about this, so he's sort of halfway prepared, although I think this is really in your wheelhouse, right?
I get made fun of a lot because I am a deep baseball fan. I love baseball. The pennant chase is coming on. I'm not long suffering anymore. I'm a Cubs fan and have been. I'm a cable Cubby. Been a Cubs fan since I was since 86, not 2016. I'm an 86 Cubs fan. You have to identify yourself now.
You
can't. I mean, you know, Ryan Sandberg was my hero back in the day as a kid. So with that being said. I always wonder about this a lot when I'm watching a baseball game, because I've coached baseball and I've had to buy equipment, and I'm thinking about, man, they really go through a lot of baseballs during the game.
Yes, they do.
And so it got me to thinking, all right, what is the average lifespan of a baseball during a baseball game? How many pitches?
Man, that's a great question. I don't know. What, 8 pitches?
Well, that's actually pretty close. Seven. Seven
really?
Pitches. And so let's run the math on that for just a second. 7 pitches. Most teams will average for their team throw 146 pitches each team. So you multiply that by 2 because you obviously have 2 teams that are playing. So that's 292 pitches. So that roughly averages out to 42 baseballs a game that are just the game now. Okay. Now, my mind goes, because I've seen the budget on baseball, how much does a baseball cost?
Yeah.
Well, baseball, MLB gets it at a discounted rate because they buy in bulk, like you and I. $5 a baseball. So that's
$5.
$5 a ball.
Okay.
And so that's $210 a game, okay? Home baseball players play about 81 games a year. And so you multiply you guys that are good at math, I don't know if I actually did this original math just right, but if you multiply.
Well, don't ask me, because I.
$210 times 81 games, that's $17,010 a year they use just on game balls.
Wow.
Now, that's every team. But, you know, baseball makes millions and billions and billions of dollars.
Yeah,
The Marlins sold for like $1.something billion to Derek Jeter and his group. I can't understand that type of money. Can't.
That's unfathomable.
Yeah.
Well, you dropped some knowledge on us. So I'm going to be counting now from now on. I'll be watching and counting how many baseballs they use.
Yeah, just that's dollar signs.
Well, a lot of times they only use them like one pitch. It hits the dirt and they throw it away.
We're like, when we were growing up, it's like, oh, man, you got plenty of life left in that
ball.
I go to my kids' ball game and you can't even see the ball. It's brown
that's
and
exactly
yellow.
Right.
But in MLB, it's perfect pearly white every time.
Yeah, that's incredible. All right, that's fantastic. I did not know that. I had not even thought about that, but that's pretty cool. All right, let me give you one. Did you know? And I'm sure you knew this. You are a scholar among scholars, as a pastor, working on a doctorate. But did you know, for all of our listeners, did you know that Jesus, and I'm going spiritual, did you know that Jesus was born somewhere between 4 and 7 BC? A lot of our folks think that he was born at zero, right? Zero BC. And that's when sort of time started. But it actually was not then. We can do the calculations of math. We don't have that in the Bible. But if you do the math, you can figure out that Jesus was actually born 4 to 7 years before we turn to the year of our Lord AD.
Yeah.
So a lot of people don't.
I had heard that. I was halfway awake in class when they talked about that in seminary.
You remember that. That's good. All right. Well, that's my did you know. So let me close the podcast. Thankful that you're here. We'll look forward to Micah being back with us next time on Gospel Rain. We thank you for listening in. Check us out on our website, gospelrain.com. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. Find us on iTunes. Find us in a lot of different places out there. Share it with your friends. But we'll see you again next time for Gospel Rain.
Thank you for joining us for the Gospel Rain podcast. We hope you've been encouraged today, and we pray the gospel will reign in your life this week. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or check out our website at gospelrain.com.